Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Finding someone on an online Catholic dating site shouldn't be like shopping for a blender. So why do most dating sites leave you feeling like you're shopping for a spouse? At Catholic Singles, we connect members through our unique user polls and activities, which help you discover other members and their personalities and interests. Because you're a person, not a profile picture. So stop shopping and start discerning. Trust your love story to the original Catholic dating site and use the promo code BREADBOX at checkout for 20% off at catholicsingles.com.
Hello, and a very groovy Thursday to you. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and it's Open Forum on Thursday, 2 hours with Jimmy Akin today, and you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. If you have a question, whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call, and I would say all the things that you can ask about, you know, the sacraments and Jesus and the Bible, but it goes even beyond that. Whatever you want to ask Jimmy, he's probably going to do his very best. Well, I know he'll do his very best to give you an answer, but he'll probably have an answer for you. 888-318-7884. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of a new book that'll be coming out soon that I want to talk to him about because I want you all well, I'll tell you why in a second. But he's also the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, which came out last year and has been selling like gangbusters since then because it turns out Catholics and the wider Christian community would really like to know where the Bible came from and who wrote it and what it's about and how you can make sense of it. Jimmy Akin, welcome.
Howdy. How's it going?
Very, very well. Okay. So the new book is kind of an invitation for people to come into the Catholic Church or, and this one's really important, I think, come back after maybe you have been away for a while.
Yeah. Like maybe because of COVID or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's important work. When does it come out? And can you get it in bulk so you can share it with people?
Yes. Okay. It will be available in bulk. I think they're taking pre-orders for it now at shop.catholic.com.
Oh, all right.
It will be out later this year. I turned in my author changes to the edits on the manuscript day or two ago and am excited to have it coming out.
Good. Also, what's the name of it?
The Words of Eternal Life.
The Words of Eternal Life. Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jimmy.
Subtitled True Happiness and Where to Find It.
Okay. All right. And now I think I interrupted you. You were about to say something else, too.
Well, I was just going to say, I, you know, you were inviting people to call with all kinds of questions and express the hope I would have an answer for them. And I do try to have answers for people, even on questions I wasn't really expecting. Yesterday, I found myself in a conversation about why we can't see stars beyond a certain distance and the properties of light and why you can't see a flashlight if you are shining one from the cliffs of Dover across the Straits of Dover to Calais. And I provided a basic but understandable scientific explanation of all that. So
that is so weird because I have been wondering about just that question. If I stand on the cliffs of Dover, why can't they see my flashlight in Calais? And I'm fascinated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if it's during the daytime, it's because the light from your flashlight is overwhelmed by the light from the sun. If it's at night, it's because of a couple of things. One of them is the small size of your flashlight because it doesn't put out that many photons. And the other factor is because it's not coherent columnar light. It scatters.
Yeah.
And so the light diffuses. And so even though it's putting out a certain number of photons that you could see up close, as they cross the channel, they spread out. And so not enough of them reach the eye of the observer on the other side to be able to detect them because the human eye isn't sensitive enough to detect below a certain threshold. But if the light you have is bigger, let's say it's not a flashlight, but a giant stadium light, then mm-hmm. you can see it across the coast. In fact, there are photos online of here's the Dover coast at night, and you can see these light sources on the other side, but they're big lights. They
yeah.
put out way more photons, and so the scattering doesn't matter. Or what you could do is you could, instead of using a light that just scatters like a normal light, you could use a laser that has coherent columnar light that doesn't scatter. And in that case, the photons would go straight across the channel. And if you held up a target, the laser would make just a little bit bigger a circle on the Calais side than on the Dover side. Of course, you'd want to use a target because you wouldn't want a laser shining directly into your eye. But you would be able to see it if all that light was kept together in a narrow beam.
All right. For all you people in Calais, that explains a lot for you. I don't know what the rest of the world, if that works everywhere. I assume it does. It's a good thing, though, that the flashlights can't get over there because they'd never get any sleep in Calais with all the people with their flashlights over in Dover. That would be very unfair. Yeah. 888-318-7884. The number open forum means open. We would love to take your call. It's been a little – we haven't had very many – I'm trying to think this week if we've had any atheists or agnostic folks call. Maybe I think one, but I want you to feel welcome. Jimmy loves talking with you. If you want to challenge us on our belief in God, or we just like to kind of get some clarity on why we believe in God, all the way up to the person who might be a cradle Catholic, well catechized with a specific question, it's all welcome. 888-318-7884. Let's start off in Westfield, Indiana, where Steve is watching on YouTube Live. Steve, your question for Jimmy.
Howdy.
Hi, Steve.
My question is about the geography of the feeding of the 5,000. I was looking at the different Gospels the other day, and Luke 9 seems to indicate that the whole thing happened in Bethsaida. And then if I look at the other Gospels and I kind of put them together, it says that they had to cross the sea afterwards, and they were going to Bethsaida across the Sea of Tiberias. And John even seems to have a little clue in there that says he was near the city of Tiberias because boats had been coming from there to where they landed after the walking on water incident. So it seems like between Luke and the others, it looks like they're identifying different sides of the Sea of Tiberias where this took place. So I was hoping to get some clarity on that.
Okay, so I haven't had a chance to look up the particular passages that you're referring to, but I'll do what I can to answer it off the top of my head. It is well known that the biblical authors, when they're describing things, they use a degree of approximation very frequently. And so what we do find from the Gospels is that this was out in the countryside. It wasn't in the middle of a city, and it apparently was close to Bethsaida. Now, there is some archaeological ambiguity about precisely where some of these sites were located, and archaeologists have theories about some of them, but it's not entirely certain. We're not 100% sure of exactly where all of these sites were along the coast of the Sea of Galilee, also known as the Sea of Tiberias or the Lake of Tiberias. I would be surprised. I would want to check, but you know, my mental image of where this happened is in fact not close to the city of Tiberias itself, which is way over. I mean, it's where Tel Aviv is now. Not where Tel Aviv is, but it's on the western side of the Sea of Galilee. And this appears to have happened along the northern coast. Now, John, if that's what he said, could be speaking even more approximatively. Instead of focusing on a minor village like Bethsaida, he could have been focusing, okay, where's the nearest big city to help give people an idea? And that might have been Tiberias. Tiberias was certainly larger than some of the other tiny little fishing villages that were located here. There's also a problem that comes when you read about crossing to the other side. This is something that the British scholar Richard Baucom has made a point out of. It sometimes, and this crops up more in connection with the Gospel of Mark, but you've had some people criticize Mark's geography and saying, well, this is wrong. They're not really going from one side to another. And the modern critics who make those points are thinking like a person who has a satellite view of the lake and is looking down at it from above. And so when they think of the other side, they mean something dramatically different, like going from the west side to the east side of the lake. But what they're not thinking like is a Galilean fisherman, which is what St. Peter was, and Peter was the primary source of Mark's gospel. And actually, if you think through the narrative directions in Mark from the perspective of a Galilean fisherman, crossing to the other side means something very different than what you would think if you're navigating as a fisherman compared to what you would think if you're looking at a satellite map of the entire lake all at once. And Baucom has pointed out, once you take that into account, the kind of dead reckoning directions that we get about they went to the other side, it actually makes perfect sense once you're thinking about it from the perspective of someone who's sailing on the surface, doing these short hops between different nearby fishing locations compared to what you would see if you're looking from a God's eye or satellite perspective down on the lake as a whole. So I hope that gives you some sense of the factors that I would apply. But like I said, this one was kind of sprung on me without references that I could look up. So can't give you more precision at the moment.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate the call. Thanks for getting us started. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy Akin is also the instructor in the first course of apologetics at the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics, a longtime dream here of many people at Catholic Answers, to provide a school of apologetics where people can learn to do what our apologists do. And you got to start at the beginning. And Jimmy's course, Beginning Apologetics, is very popular. Lots and lots of people have taken it. And we'd like you to give it a try to see if it's something you'd like to take. So we're giving away a free trial class. One of the classes in Jimmy's Beginning Apologetics course is available online for free. You just go to catholic.com/free trial. catholic.com/free trial. And then if you like what you see and you want to take advantage of the full course, you can have $50 off as a special kind of sign up and give this Catholic Answers School of Apologetics a try kind of deal. So let me give it to you again, and do take this class. It's a free class, you'll enjoy it. It's with Jimmy Akin, Beginning Apologetics, catholic.com/free trial.
Hi, this is Trevor Williams from the Pittsburgh Pirates, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy. Catholic Answers Focus is our podcast for deeper dives into individual faith topics. We spend a half hour or so with an expert, apologist, philosopher, or theologian on a single topic. This week, we talk astrology with Father Hugh on Monday's episode. And then on Wednesday, we ask Jimmy Akin to defend belief in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Catch each episode on YouTube or listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, or join us on our website, CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN is now on Twitter. Get short, timely messages from EWTN on your computer or cell phone. It's easy to stay up to date on a wide variety of topics. Pro-life news, Vatican announcements, catechesis, apologetics, the latest EWTN programming, and more. You can link to EWTN on Twitter from our homepage or go to twitter.com/EWTN. At work, at home, at school, and on the road, stay connected to your world with EWTN's Twitter page.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, both hours today. So plan for some fun for the next couple hours. Sean in Fort Perry, Canada, listening on the Amazon Alexa is next. Sean, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. I'd like to share something with you before I ask my question, because you and I are very unique. We're both pipe smokers.
Okay.
Yeah, I know you don't like long introductions. What I wanted to ask you was the manna that God provided in the desert to the people of Israel whilst they were crossing from Egypt into Canaan. What exactly was that manna, and how did it get down from the sky, and what did it consist of?
Well, we don't know for sure. We have the descriptions that are offered of it in the Torah, and we're told a few basic facts about it. We're told that it was that it sort of appeared in a fleck-like manner, and would be you'd gather it kind of by scooping it up, and that it tasted something like coriander seed. And you could make cakes out of it, and it wouldn't, under ordinary circumstances, last more than a day. It would go bad. There have been various attempts to explain it as maybe some kind of natural phenomenon that God providentially provided for the Israelites. You know, it was maybe some kind of secretion of a biological nature, you know, from plants or other living creatures that God used to make provision for the Israelites, that it had nutritional value for them. However, if it was a natural phenomenon, that's something that it's one that the Israelites clearly were not aware of, because they didn't know what this was. And in fact, that's where the name manna comes from. It comes from the question they would ask, what is this stuff? This is the what's it? We don't know what to call it. And so consequently, they didn't know what it was, and we really aren't given enough details to be able to identify it as a known natural phenomenon, although there have been some proposals. But, you know, if it was a supernatural thing that God caused to happen, then it wouldn't fit into any of our natural categories. And so we wouldn't expect to be able to find out what it was beyond just something that God supernaturally caused to appear. Later authors somewhat poetically would describe it as the bread of angels. They interpreted it as a supernatural phenomenon. And they may not have meant literally angels eat this stuff, but that was a way of communicating that it was food or bread. In fact, in the ancient world, in this period in history, bread was the dominant form of food, such that the Hebrew word lechem, which means bread, also just meant food. So you could also translate it the food of angels, because this was food, but it also came from heaven. And so you could link it to the angels, whether they literally ate it or not. And presumably they wouldn't, because they don't have physical bodies. They're pure spirits. But that's a kind of a poetic expression. And so we have to live with some mystery here, one of the many parts of our mysterious world.
Jimmy, nice little reference there. How's that, Sean? Make sense?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean. Appreciate the call.
Thanks for calling.
By the way, the mysterious world reference. Tomorrow, the final of, is it, tomorrow is the third.
Second.
Oh, tomorrow's the second. Okay, I'm all messed up on my week. Tomorrow's the second in your series of three on the age of the world.
Yeah, do faith and science require us to believe we're living on a young Earth, or may we be living on an older one?
Up next, Chris in Long Island, New York, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Fi.
Got a question for Jimmy?
I have a question.
Okay.
I do. Thank you. I was working as a medical secretary in a urology practice where they did perform vasectomies from time to time. My involvement in that would be scheduling appointments or collecting copays, and it always kind of just sat on my conscience. So I'm wondering if that it would be considered a sin that should be confessed.
Well, so you weren't doing the vasectomies themselves. And so by simply, you know, moving information around, passing on messages from one party to another is essentially what you were doing. That's not intrinsically evil. It's not intrinsically evil to say person A says this and tell that to person B. That simply passing on a message is not intrinsically wrong in and of itself. Even if the content of the message is something that shouldn't be happening. For example, if person A says he's going to kill person B, well, it's immoral to kill someone, but it wouldn't be sinful for me to say, person A says he's going to kill you to person B. So merely passing on a message that describes something that shouldn't happen is not itself intrinsically immoral. Now, that means that the participation you would have had or the cooperation you would have had with this was somewhat remote. And whether it's remote enough to remove all culpability or not is something that, if you want a professional opinion on, I would contact the National Catholic Bioethics Center at ncbcenter.org and ask for a consultation with one of their medical moral experts. In terms of, is it something that needs to be confessed, though? Well, if this was a mortal sin, it would need to be confessed. And in order for it to have been a mortal sin, there would need to have been grave matter, and you would have needed to do it knowingly and deliberately in spite of that fact. So did you perceive yourself at the time as doing something gravely immoral and just deliberately go ahead and do it anyway at the time?
No, I think it just was on my conscience because I know that, mm-hmm. you know, according to the Catholic faith, I'm a relatively new Catholic, that is uh-huh. wrong, you know, to do. Mm-hmm. And I would actually pray, you know, that they would not go through with it after they went for the consultation or maybe even back out, you know, silently, of course, because mm-hmm. it did bother me.
Well, even if it bothered you somewhat, if you didn't knowingly and deliberately say this, I'm doing something, not they're doing something, but I'm doing something gravely wrong and I don't care, I'm doing it anyway, then it wasn't a mortal sin for you and you don't need to confess it. But like I said, if you, for historical interest or for future reference, if you want a professional opinion on, you know, whether this form of cooperation is permitted or not, I would contact the National Catholic Bioethics Center.
Okay, Chris.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thanks.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Sure.
Great to talk with you. It's always nice to talk with someone new into the Catholic Church, and welcome home to you. And call anytime. We move now. Yeah, I got time. Let's go to Richard in Fort Worth, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Jimmy Akin. How are you?
Doing okay.
Good. My question is, you know how the Protestants believe that you can receive Jesus Christ spiritually into heart, and we do too, but when we go to communion and we receive Jesus physically and spiritually into our body, how long does he stay with us? Does he stay with us till we sin? Does he stay with us just 10 minutes? You know, because the Protestants, they believe he's with you forever and you never have to do it again, right?
Well, okay, that's an oversimplification. There are a lot of different, it's almost very rare that you would find an idea on which everyone in the Protestant community is agreed. They tend to have a wide variety of opinions on different subjects. And many Protestants believe in the real presence in the Eucharist. And they believe that you receive Jesus anew. I mean, I'm talking, for example, about Lutherans and various Anglicans and Methodists and so forth. They would say we receive Jesus bodily in the Eucharist, and you receive him anew every time you receive the Eucharist. And there may be different opinions about, you know, how long does his bodily presence remain with us compared to his spiritual presence. Other various Protestants also will say, well, if you sin, you are in some sense distancing yourself from his presence. So you can lose his spiritual presence as well as his bodily presence. So I wouldn't paint this as a the Catholics versus the Protestants type issue. There's going to be a considerable amount of overlap in opinions on this question. Regarding the question, we need to distinguish between Christ's bodily presence in the Eucharist and the spiritual presence of Christ with us. Now, the first one, the bodily presence from a Catholic point of view, lasts as long as the appearances or accidents of bread and wine have not been corrupted. So as long as you would look at, you know, the precious blood and say, oh, this is drinkable wine, well, the Eucharistic presence, Christ's bodily presence, would still be there. As long as you looked at the host and said, oh, this is an eatable piece of bread, Christ's bodily presence would be there. But that very quickly changes upon consumption of the Eucharist. Now, some people have speculated, well, maybe it'll last 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes, maybe. But what Catholic theology is traditionally held is once the accidents become corrupt, it's Christ's bodily presence is no longer there. And I don't know that I would say it would last as long as some people propose, because it seems to me when you drink the precious blood or when you receive the body of Christ under the form of bread, the accidents are corrupted very quickly. And so the bodily presence wouldn't remain for a long period of time. What will remain is Christ's spiritual presence with us. And that will remain as long as we haven't committed mortal sin. So, and his spiritual presence also works on more than one level. But as just a basic answer, I would say you can expect his spiritual presence to remain until you commit a mortal sin. And it'll even continue to remain in some sense after that, because baptism and confirmation permanently unite us to Christ. And so we're never totally deprived of his spiritual presence, but there is a sense in which mortal sin will cause it to leave us. So even that operates on more than one level. And these are things that you will find, even though they may understand various aspects of them a little differently, these are things that you will find many Protestants agreeing with.
Okay, Richard.
Okay. I was just wondering, because, you know, you get in the car after communion, you're driving home, and I'm talking to Jesus, and I'm wondering, well, is he with me? Is he not? Is he that's the question I had.
Jesus is omniscient. He always knows when you're talking to him. Beyond that, I would suggest leave it in his hands and just love and worship the Lord.
Thanks, Richard. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's open forum for both hours today. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. More of your calls for Jimmy right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
How can the Eucharist truly be Christ's body? Does belief in the real presence mean that Catholics are cannibals? Do the Bible and early Christians support Catholic teaching on the Eucharist? In 20 Answers, the Eucharist, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, helping you deepen your own appreciation for this most precious sign of Christ's enduring presence in the world. 20 Answers the Eucharist is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the Church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, open forum today, and all the lines full at the moment, so we will dig right back in. Joe in Tacoma, Washington, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Joe, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I had a real disturbing conversation today with a coworker about sanctity of life and kids in third world countries having kids. And can you explain to me, how many children is enough in the eyes of the church, and either preventing pregnancy or not, because this person feels that the Catholics' teaching that life is precious promulgates child exploitation in these countries, that, you know, women will tend to give up the young girls to older men. These girls end up getting pregnant, having kids,
and
they're turning around having kids.
Okay. That's a pretty heavy accusation, Joe. Let's see what Jimmy has to say.
There's no set number of children that the church says a person should or must have. What the church teaches is that if you're married and your circumstances permit it, you should be open to having children. But there's not a single set number that you need to have for it to be enough. For some people, for the unmarried, for example, zero children is enough. Even if you're married, zero children may be the appropriate number in your circumstance. You may have, you may be past the age of childbearing, or you may be infertile, or you may be living in dire poverty where you and your spouse are barely keeping yourselves alive, and there's not enough, there aren't enough resources available to you to keep even a single extra mouth fed. And so there's no set number. Zero may be the appropriate amount. On the other hand, if those aren't your circumstances, if you're able to take care of more children, then it's a good thing to be open to those children if God grants them to you to, you know, have more children than that. People are good. They're intrinsically valuable. And to bring new people into the world is a good thing. Now, this is a question, since it involves your circumstances, it's a question that involves prudence. And so people are expected to use prudent judgment in trying to determine how many children are appropriate in their circumstances. And they can take reasonable steps to see that an appropriate number of children are or are not had. If they're having difficulty conceiving, they can use various legitimate means to try to ensure a conception. But if they've discerned that prudently this is not the time to have a child, given what's going on, they can also use legitimate means like natural family planning or simple abstinence to avoid having a child at a given point. So it oversimplifies the question to make it sound like there is some magic number of children the church expects people to have, and abortion or contraception are the only alternatives to having more children than what's appropriate. Neither one of those is true. The church does not expect people to have a certain number of children, and abortion and contraception are not the only ones, are not the only ways that people have of legitimately regulating the number of children they have. So your friend is oversimplifying in a number of ways. Also, I would say your friend is running the risk of being a little condescending towards women in other cultures and presuming that they aren't in charge of what's happening with their families, and that they would deliberately betray their children by putting them in oppressive situations. I think you may have even alluded to human trafficking there. Any sane parent in any culture, Christian or not, who loves their children is not going to be doing that. And it frankly is a little, it runs the risk of being a little out of touch and clueless to, from a distance, try to diagnose situations that other people are in other parts of the world, and think you know better than the people who are actually involved in those situations.
And I think we will leave it there. Thank you very, very much for the question. Appreciate it, Joe. Let's see now. We're going to another Joe in Pennsylvania watching on YouTube Live. Hi, Joe. You got a question for Jimmy?
Hi. Yes. My question is in regard to the Vatican II document, Lumen Gentium. Particularly the statement on unity with Muslims. I'm okay with the statement that Muslims profess to hold the faith of Abraham, because it kind of implies that they don't really have that faith in its fullness, I guess. But then it goes on to make a kind of statement of unity by saying that we as Catholics adore and worship the one merciful God with them. So is it possible, my question is it possible to worship God together with Muslims if we're not united in faith, like the first part of the statement implies?
Okay, so let me ask you a question. Now, when it talks about, actually the way the passage says it is that, you know, what the passage means is we worship the one true God and they worship the one true God. So it doesn't mean we're holding joint worship services where we do that together. You know, Catholics worship in churches, Muslims worship in mosques. We both worship at home, but we're not holding joint worship services, certainly not typically. So that's not what the council means when it says that. What it means is we both are directing worship towards the one true God. So let me ask you a question. Do we in Jews do that? What do you think, Joe?
Like if you were to replace the statement, take out Muslims and put Jews there?
Yep. Do Jews worship the true God?
I would say not in the fullness of the way that in the same way that we do as Catholics.
Okay,
but
that fine. That
in a closer way than Muslims do, I guess.
Yeah. Well, okay, that's interesting, but fundamentally, if Jews are talking to God, does God know that they're talking to him?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
Okay, good. So if Muslims are talking to God, does God know that they're talking to him?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So if Jews say something nice about God, if they're praising him or worshiping him, let's say you have a Jewish person that's saying the God who created the world is wonderful and merciful. Does God know that they are praising him?
Yeah, I think he would know that that's what they're attempting to do. Yeah.
Good. And if Muslims say, oh, the God who created the world is wonderful and merciful, does God know that they're praising him?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So what this shows us is that God knows if you're talking to him, which is prayer, or if you're worshiping him, which is praise. So so people of different faiths, Jews, Christians, Muslims, can all direct their remarks to God and their speech about God so that they're talking to God in prayer and they're praising God in worship. That doesn't mean they all share the same faith, because Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are three different faiths. They have somewhat different understandings of God, especially Christians. Christians understand that God is a Trinity, whereas non-Christian Jews and Muslims do not understand that God is a Trinity, but they do understand that God created the world, that there's a single divinity that did that, and that this God also appeared to Abraham, and they talk to this God in prayer, and they praise this God in worship. And so even though they may have an incomplete or at times erroneous understanding of this God, God still knows that they're talking to him and in prayer and talking about him in praise. And this is something that we similarly see on the human level. I may not perfectly understand another human being, like, say, Cy Kellett. There are many aspects of Cy Kellett's life I know nothing about because I only met him a few years ago and he hasn't told me everything. So I have an incomplete understanding of Cy Kellett. Also, I probably misunderstand a few things about Cy Kellett. But if I talk to Cy Kellett and say, Cy Kellett, how are you doing? How are you doing, Cy?
Great. Thank you, Jimmy.
Okay. Cy knew I was talking to him. And if I say nice things about Cy Kellett, if I praise him and say, Cy Kellett is a great radio host,
Thank you.
Then Psychelet can know I'm talking about him. He can know I'm praising him. And if that's how it works on the human level, even though I have an incomplete and probably in some respects erroneous understanding of Psychelet, then the same thing can apply to God. God understands even more than Psychelet. And so God knows if when you're talking to him or about him, even if you don't understand him fully or perfectly.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I think maybe I was getting caught up on the worship word because, but I think that's a great answer. So thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
No problem. Just worship is something, the English word worship comes from worth-ship. So what you're doing when you worship someone is testifying to their worth. You're talking about their worthy attributes, or in other words, in more modern English, you're praising them. And so you're noting their good qualities. And that's fundamentally what worship speech is.
Joe, we got to take a break. So thank you very, very much for the call. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum. Lots of folks on the line. Before we go to the break, I want to remind you that this month we have a free ebook for you, 20 Answers, Witchcraft and the Occult. It's available right now at shop.catholic.com. You click on the button at the top of the page, and you get the free ebook, 20 Answers, Witchcraft and the Occult. At shop.catholic.com.
Call us now with your question. Hello? On Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I just wanted to thank the station for being there on the radio for all of us Catholics. We're all trying to learn something new every day about ourselves and about the world we live in and the people that we interact with. Thank you for taking my question. I appreciate your willingness to be on the radio these days.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and we head to Florida now. Edward, watching on YouTube in Florida. You're next. Edward, you there with us?
Yeah. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy.
Hi. I got a questions that all fit in the same category, but my question is, what is the Book of Enoch? Why was it written, and what's with this big accuracy, this big support for it?
Okay. So the Book of Enoch, and here I assume we're referring to the first Book of Enoch. There's actually a second and a third Book of Enoch, but those usually aren't what people mean when they talk about the Book of Enoch. They usually mean the first. This is a book that was written in the first few centuries before Christ, so it did exist by the time of Christ. It is actually an anthology of several different works that are all related to the patriarch Enoch. It originally was written either in Hebrew or in Aramaic, and we found extensive portions of it in Aramaic among the Dead Sea Scrolls, although it is also, we also have Greek portions of it, and we especially have the whole thing in a language called Ge'ez, which is the liturgical language of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, and they preserved the full part of it. The book is what's known as an apocalypse. An apocalypse is a kind of work, it's a kind of literature where someone, a prophet, gets either a tour of the invisible world. So you like get a behind the scenes tour of heaven and maybe hell and other places, but you get to look at what's going on in the invisible world, or You have predictions about the future, very often veiled in symbolic form, like what we find in Daniel or in the book of Revelation. Or an apocalypse can give you both. It may include both a tour of the invisible world and prophetic passages that usually contain symbolism. And the book of Enoch has both of those. So Enoch gets a tour of the invisible world, and he also gets a look into the future. In terms of why it's currently popular, well, it is related, and it provides some background information on some rather mysterious passages in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. There are a variety of passages that have been very mysterious to ordinary interpreters for a long time, such as the reference to the Nephilim in Genesis 6. That's a very brief passage. It does not go into a lot of detail, and it's been very hard for people to understand since it's so brief. We're apparently missing some of the context that the ancient audience of Genesis was aware of. And there are other passages that are like that too. And it turns out when you read Enoch, you find that it contains a lot of this background. It contains a lot of information that can shed light on some of these passages. It also contains passages that can shed light on Jesus's self-understanding as the Son of Man. And so it relates to New Testament Christology as well. And in recent years, here in the West, people have begun to know more about the Book of Enoch and realize that, oh, even though it's not in our Bibles, it can shed some light on passages that are in our Bibles. And that's led a number of people kind of across the religious spectrum in Christianity to take a new interest in the Book of Enoch. And in some places, it's been kind of intense. In fact, right now, in some sections of evangelical Protestantism, there's kind of an Enoch mania that's going on. But and there are some excesses associated with some of that. But in general, it's a good thing to be aware of this book. It is quoted in the New Testament. The book of Jude quotes it. And it does provide background that can help us to understand some otherwise mysterious things in the Bible. And yes, it will be coming up on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Oh, nice. Edward, I'm really glad you asked that question because I didn't know there was an Enoch mania. Oh, Edward dropped. Okay. He got done with Jimmy's answer, and he's like, I'm not listening to Cy. Let's see. Where are we going now? Sean in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
Got a question for
Jimmy.
Go ahead.
Howdy.
Hi. God bless you both, what you guys are doing there.
Thank you, Sean.
My question is, are there any teachings or anything in the Bible that talks about Caiaphas and a good chunk of the Sanhedrin or Pontius Pilate if they believed in Jesus' resurrection?
Well, we have references to both Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council that Caiaphas was the head of. We have later references to them. And if you look in the book of Acts chapter 4, for example, you'll see that Peter and John are taken before Caiaphas and called to account for their preaching of Christ. And it's pretty clear there that Caiaphas and at least the majority of the Sanhedrin are not believers in the resurrection. Pontius Pilate is not really mentioned after the Gospels, and so we don't have an indication in Scripture of what he may or may not have believed, although it would, I mean, given the fact he was a Roman, he probably would not have believed in the resurrection, but we're not told that, so hypothetically he could have. We know a little bit more about Pontius Pilate from secular historical sources. We know that he was recalled. He got in trouble with the Roman authorities, with his bosses in Rome, and he was recalled in the year 36 and ended up in I think France I want to say. But we're not told about his religious views, really, after that. We are told in the book of Acts that as Christianity grew in prominence in Jerusalem, that many of the priests who served at the temple became Christians. They became believers in Jesus. However, at this time, there were about 8,000 priests, according to our best information, in Israel at the time. And so even if many of them became Christians, that by no means indicates that all of them did, or that a majority of the Sanhedrin became Christians. We know of two people on the Sanhedrin who were Christians, namely Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. But they're the only two members of the Sanhedrin we really know that were. We also know that another member of it, Gamaliel, was at least not opposed to Christianity, but we don't have indications that he became a Christian himself, just that he was more open to it than other people were.
Sean, thank you. Going to keep moving because I want to get to as many as I can before the top of the hour. We will continue in the next hour with open forum. So those of you on the line, do not despair. If it starts to seem like we're heading into the break, we'll get right back to you as soon as we come back. Let's go to James in Indiana, watching on Facebook Live. James, you there with us?
Hey, yes. God bless you both.
Thank you. You too, James.
My question, I am actually at this point Lutheran, wanting to head to the Catholic Church. So my question is, if I committed a mortal sin, which would require to make confession to a priest, since I don't have access to a priest at this time, what should I do about that?
Well, so as you get closer to becoming Catholic, you would be able to go to confession even before being received into the church. That's a normal part of the process for someone who's already baptized and is joining the church. Typically, before you're received, you would go to confession at least once. In an emergency circumstance, like if you were in danger of death or something, you could go to confession right now. You just need to call a parish and say, "I want to receive confession. And, you know, I believe in the sacraments, and I, you know, obviously can't receive it from a minister in my own communion, so I want to receive from a Catholic priest." And you would be permitted to do that under those emergency circumstances. However, apart from that, and obviously we hope it doesn't get to that point, but I just wanted you to be aware of that possibility in case it ever did. What you can do right now is do what is referred to in Catholic circles as making an act of perfect contrition. Contrition is a word that means sorrow. So this is sorrow for sins. It's not really emotional sorrow, although emotional sorrow may be there. What it really is a turning of the will away from sin and towards God. And the reason it's called perfect is not because it's the most intense experience you could have. It's the perfect motive for turning to God away from sin. Now, it's perfectly fine to say, "Wow, I've done something I shouldn't have, and I don't want to go to hell." You know, that's a perfectly legitimate motive, but it's not the perfect motive. The perfect motive is wanting to do what God wants because you love Him. So love of God is the perfect motive. So if you say to yourself, "God is infinitely good, and that means I want to do what He wants. And so anything in my life that would take me away from the perfect goodness of God, that would mean I defy what an infinitely good being wants me to do," If you have that as your motive, and just as a mental act, you say, "You know, I turn my back on that sin, on those mortal sins, because I love God. He's infinitely good." Well, then you have the supernatural virtue of charity, or supernatural love of God. And that of itself unites you with God. As St. Paul says, you know, even if you have all kinds of faith and hope, if you don't have love, or charity, to translate it another way, then you're nothing. And he says what counts is faith working through love or charity. So if you have, if you recognize God is infinitely good and because of that I'm going to do what he wants, you are already united with God and your sins are forgiven. Now, part of that, if you really are committed to doing what God wants, that means you're going to go to confession when it's appropriate, you know, which is a little bit down the road for you. If you said, oh, well, yeah, I kind of want to do what God wants, but I'm never going to go to confession even when it's appropriate, well, then you're not really loving God. But if you say God's infinitely good and I want to do what I want to do his will because of that, and I'm turning my back on my mortal sin, that of itself unites you with God.
I hope you found hope in that, James. We certainly find great hope and reason to rejoice in your approaching the Catholic Church. I hope you'll call again. It was great to get a chance to talk with you. The number here is 888-318-7884, and there'll be one or two lines open, but you might have to keep trying to get on with Jimmy Akin today. Jimmy is here for Open Forum, and that Open Forum will continue. If you're on the line, stay right there. If you haven't called yet, give it a try and keep trying. 888-318-7884. More right after this.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Holo is here to help. Holo is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Holo has something for everyone. Holo is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.holo.app/breadbox.